Would you please come up here, Clancy? Come on. When you get to be my age, you can't remember what you should say. You'll hear a lot of things about Clancy. Some of them might even be good. But I want to tell you a little story about Clancy. Where did you go? And I want to make sure I get it right, so I wrote it down. In July 1970, I met Clancy Imeslin at the International at Miami Beach. My sponsor, Chicago Jack Murray, introduced us. So for 37 years, our paths have intertwined and our friendship has developed. Clancy's stories are legend. Here's one near and dear to my heart. Pat Wheeler had Clancy come to speak in Marietta. He said, "Bill, he'll stay at your house." My wife Janet said, "No, he won't." And the reason she said that, she felt that our house was not worthy of having His Eminence come. So he stayed at a motel, which is what he actually prefers anyway. Now, before I took him to the motel from the airport, I took him to my home. And I knocked on the door, and my wife answered, and I said to my wife, "Here's Clancy." She was very appreciative to see him again. I brought him in the living room, and I said, "Clancy, here's the living room you could have been in if my wife wasn't a snob." And I showed him the kitchen and the bathroom. And then I said, "And these pictures you see on the wall are all done by my wife. She was an artist. She painted oils." And then we turned to Clancy, and Clancy made this statement, "Janet, I could never have stayed here." And she said, "Why? Why couldn't you?" He said, "Because I never stay anywhere where I'm in awe of the painter." Now let me tell you the benefit of that statement. The last 5 years of my wife's life, she lay in a bed. She immobilized. She couldn't walk. But whenever I said name Clancy Imeslin, she smiled.
My name is Clancy Imeslin. I'm an alcoholic. Quasimodo, you about ringing the bell, have you? Somebody said this afternoon, "You seem to be getting softer as you get older." And I'm really not. It's just showing more. Because I'm really kind of a sentimentalist. I was thinking there tonight, you know, I suppose it's kind of corny and sentimental, but if the doctor someday told me I had one day to live, I think what I'd like to do is come down here and recreate what we've heard tonight. I'd like to hear John's announcements. I'd like to hear the countdown. I'd like to hear the introduction of this committee, and then Bill's introduction. It would make that last day seem like forever. Now we're back on track, folks. I'm glad to be here. Kind of a tough trip. We had a lot of storms in the Midwest. We bounced around a lot. It was not much fun. But it was all right, you know. I've talked about this before, but a bad trip I'll tell you a bad trip, then I'll get on my business. A few years ago, I was asked to speak in Reykjavik, Iceland, which is really beyond any length. It's a, you take Air Iceland from Minneapolis to Reykjavik, which, and come back Sunday night, it was cold, and I was tired, and sat in Minneapolis, had to wait for 4 hours for a plane to Los Angeles. And I was sitting in the red carpet room, which is the United Airlines frequent flyer room, and I sat there, most hardly anybody there, everybody off doing better things, and finally I had to go to the bathroom, so I went to this bathroom, two charming little stalls side by side, little doors, and I sat in one of them and thought about things. And all of a sudden I hear a voice from the other side says, "Hi there." "What the hell is this?" I said, person, the voice said, "What are you doing tonight?" I thought, I'll put a kibosh on this now. So I'm going back to Los Angeles to my wife and my children and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. But thank you very much for asking. Now, thank you a lot. There was a long pause. The voice said, "We could really have some fun tonight." And I was tired and I overreacted. I shouldn't have. I don't know what your problem is, pal, but get off it. Just do what you're here to do and shut up. There was a long pause and the voice said, "I'll have to call you back. The jerk of the next stall won't shut up." That's what I call a bad trip. But I really enjoyed the convention. I must say that I talked this afternoon and I got very hot and sweaty and went up to my room and turned on the air conditioner and lay down, rest for a moment, and slept right through your talk. But I'll listen to the talk next week on the freeway, and if I find errors, I'll call you. Things like that I do for Polly from time to time. I was thinking, listening to the speeches, talks, and Polly's talk last night and the other talks, that, you know, we all have certain things in common. We all have certain, seems to be, emotions in common. If you're new, we have a lot of new people here tonight. This new guy, where's the old guy with one day? Take off your cap. How do you like that? You thought I was going to congratulate you, didn't you? Shape up! I want to get people off on the right foot, I say. My sponsor came up behind me at a meeting one night and took off my cap and stepped on it. I said, "What the hell are you doing that for? That's my only cap." He said, "I don't want you to wear your cap in meetings." I said, "Where in the book does it say that?" He said, if you ever had a house and I came to your house for dinner, I would not wear my cap at the table. And you got to remember, this is 100 times more important than going to your house for dinner. That's why I asked you to take your cap off, kid. Might save your bacon someday. Because you got to learn to respect this place, because someday there's going to be anybody around to congratulate you and clap for you and tell you how wonderful you are. It's going to be you and fate, and you better have a respect for aid that's going to pull you through. That's what you got to have. I told you earlier today, this is the signal for applause. This is the signal for muffled sobs. I told you that. But like, we all have certain things, you know. I talked about the book today and people calling it a miracle, and seems why should it be called a miracle? We got around to why it should be. But and you sit all the way in the middle, don't you? Well, I see our time is up, friends. I hate to be standing here speaking when couples are dancing by. I know, you know, the band is playing and I'm still talking. And then in 1954... But that book, I remember reading it and hearing it read. In Los Angeles, we read chapter 5, the page and a half. And we also, sometimes they read chapter 3, and they read the traditions. And chapter 3, I must have heard that thing read 100 times. And I was sober for some time before I realized, my God, that's my story. And I never understood it. And I wonder, why didn't I understand it? Like old Chuck, he used to say, you can't hear till you can hear, and you can't see till you can see. But if you're new to it, you may wonder, you look at the chapter 3, there are some things in there that you have in common with us. You look around, what do you have in common with these people? Very little. Different sizes, shapes, colors, backgrounds, all drinking histories are all a little different. What the hell do we have in common? And it turns out for people like us, alcoholics of our type, are people who, no matter how many times they stop drinking, always start again. Or they come out of treatment centers or out of basements, they start again. But alcoholics of our type have certain things in common, and he talks about them in chapter 3. Among the most important is that people like us, apparently, some or all along the line, have voluntarily or involuntarily accepted the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. It says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many people have pursued it in the gates of insanity and death. And people can't understand why we do it. Why do you keep drinking what it's doing to you? Then it talks about how we continue to drink and how we fight to continue to drink. And then we have brief recoveries, which, oh, what a terrible thing for us. A brief recovery. We've all had those. I've had them, you know. I remember to eat before I go out and put some butter on my stomach or something, you know, whatever it might be. Followed always by a still worse relapse. If you hadn't been followed by a relapse, you wouldn't be here today. You'd still be out doing all right. And you keep drinking and fighting this problem. And as Polly talked about, and most people talk about, that cunning little phrase in that chapter, reaching a stage of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I remember reading that thing, boy, those people really get drunk when they get like that. But that isn't what that means. That's how you feel after you sober up. And people want explanations from you for your behavior, and you haven't got them. And the correct answer is, leave me alone. Leave me alone. Then they go on to talk about this little funny little paragraph of things that people do like us. Change from one kind of booze to another. Drink beer only. Drink wine only. That's a good one. Read spiritual literature. Take physical exercises. Take trips. Not take trips. I've tried every one of those things, except one. I never tried not taking a trip. So it's been my experience that people who face the consequences of their actions are weak. I'm gone. And it baffles people around us why we continue doing this. And that's why people have been trying to help alcoholics of our type for 4,000 years with singular lack of success until relatively recently, the last few years. And there's never been, I mean, scientists and medicine and doctors and social service people. And one time they thought people like us were possessed by devils. Put them to death and send them away and just flog them and put them in prisons. There's never been an answer until relatively recently. Now, I think if you're like me, alcoholics of our type don't see all of those efforts. What we see, the pattern of the illness in the face of people who love us. And you see that look, God, that look of, oh, look at you. How could you? You promised. You were doing so well. And you're going back to work and everything was fine. And now you're drunk. How could you do that? What's the answer to that? Leave me alone. I don't know. Leave me alone. And that's what makes people like us have a lot deal of difficulty. Because there's no reason we should drink, and yet we drink. And for many of us, come to Alcoholics Anonymous. They give you a bunch of non-applicable things. Admit that your problem is alcohol. Return to God. Admit that you're insane. Turn your life over to God. Write down things you wouldn't tell anybody and give them to some blabbermouth. There's nothing here that really catches your attention. I mean, and so guys, some guys just never stay around. I came to my first meeting and I thought it was very simple. And I stayed there for a little while and realized I learned the things I just talked about. And that Alcoholics Anonymous is a place for people whose problem is alcohol. And they come to AA and they admit their problem is alcohol. And they return to God and they show their gratitude by helping others and they live pretty happily. And I lasted about 3 weeks because it has nothing to do with me. I don't apply in any case. My problem is not alcohol. I'm not going to return to God. And you don't just understand. And this went on for almost 10 years. I started off as a high bottom drunk. Over a period of time, I became a medium bottom drunk. The last day I drank, two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles and said, "Stay out of here, you bum." I tried to explain to them, "I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the L.C. Elmiraj for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and Saturday Post, New Yorker. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements." But it's hard to explain these things in midair. You know. And I stood outside that damn old mission on the corner of 4th and Los Angeles Street, and it was raining, and I was sick, and I was cold, and I had a terrible feeling. I didn't know what the feeling was. I know what it is now because I've sponsored a couple guys who've had it, and I'm sure some people in this room have had it. But you get to a point where suddenly you realize there's no friendly direction. There's no direction that's better than any other direction. There's nobody that wants to see you. There's no place to go back to. And I stood in the rain, and some little guy would have come up to me that morning and said, "You know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children, never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. You can't even get a job washing dishes now. You've lost all your ID and all your clothing and the clothes in the car. The man asked you to drive from Dallas to Los Angeles to help you get out of Texas. And you got drunk in Phoenix and lost everything. Can't find the car, can't find your ID, can't find your clothes. And you remember that day, that was the day where you got in a fight in the street corner with a guy, turned out to be a plainclothes cop, and he threw you in jail overnight. In the middle of the night, you were so sick, 130 degrees up there in the drunk tank. Went over to vomit and vomited. You thought it was the toilet, trying to be a guy's bunk. And there was nobody in it. But I vomited and felt better, so I laid down next to his bunk and my cheek on the tile and trying to sleep. And this guy came back with some trustee or something, wherever he'd been, and found his bunk full of vomit, and me laying next to him, "Damn you!" And he got mad and kicked, I don't think he meant to do it, kicked my front teeth out. He said, "You remember that, don't you? Because you got no front teeth and you're bleeding every time you talk." And he might have said, "Your little mother up in Wisconsin, you're an only child, like Polly. And she's no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you because your stepfather's so tired of watching you play on her emotions. So she'll go down to her tiny little bank account and take out a few more dollars and send it to her little boy and try to help him. He'd rather have her think you're dead than the way you are." And he might have said, "You've been sitting in AA meetings now for almost 10 years and you smirk and laugh at these idiots who use AA to get the heat off you. And it's just, you laugh or ridicule them secretly, talk about them in bars and how stupid they are, and now you're dying." And he might have said, "Why don't you go back to AA one more time and admit you're an alcoholic and see what happens?" And if some guy had said that to me, and if I were in a mood to be honest, I'd have to say, "You don't understand. I'm not really an alcoholic. I wish I were. I wish I were. My life would be so much more simple. I have a lot of problems, but I wish alcohol were the number one. I've had problems since I was a little boy. When I was a little boy, I remember thinking, there's something missing in me. I don't know what it is. But I know when I, at a distance, people seem to like me. I get up close, I don't seem to get along very well for some reason. I don't know how to make friends or how to keep friends. And I don't know how to join anything and be a part of it. I just always feel different. And I thought my group's going to be different. And when I grew up, it was different. I had a lot of different problems, but the feelings were still there. It's almost as though if you're supposed to kind of feel like this in some inner scale, I feel like this a lot of the time. And I've spent, as I said today, thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis when I was successful. And I read a lot of books. I did a lot of intellectual, I thought intellectual things. And nothing ever helped. But when I was 15 years old, a screwed up little boy, I was in trouble. I hadn't thought about this, you know, before that. I grew up in the Norwegian Lutheran Church up in Wisconsin. Most of you have never heard of it. It's a strict church. Our dropouts become Southern Baptist ministers. And I got along fine, and I was raised in a very lot of discipline, a lot of structure, and I could sing little songs in Norwegian. I was confirmed and catechized, and by the time I was 12, I'd been shoved ahead in school a year and a half. I was getting straight A's in school, and I was getting along fine. And my parents got a divorce. That's no big deal. A lot of people get divorced. Can you imagine at the age of 12, I had never heard of a divorce? I'd never heard of one. Nobody ever, I don't know what our church ever had, but nobody in our family ever had one. And it just baffled me. And someone explained it to me. I understood it, but I still, they were missing. And I reacted in the worst possible way that I could. I didn't know it at the time. I began playing my mother against my father to get out of the discipline I was in. And I outsmarted him again and again. My mother gave me hell, I'd run to my father and tell him stories about her. My father gave me hell, I'd run to my mother and tell her stories about him. They both got on me and run to my grandma. And I fooled him again and again. By the time I was 15, I'd fooled him completely. But I was flunking out of high school. I had no friends left. I had taken refuge behind a kind of a wall of cynicism and smart aleckness. Nobody liked me anymore. I was on my way to, I believe, to the penitentiary sooner or later. And what saved me, the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor. And I got caught up in watching the war and going to the movies and seeing the war and the Japs. And one day I thought, that's what I need to do. I need to become a war hero, get overseas and be something. And I told my mother I wanted to visit my aunt in Duluth, and she gave me a little suitcase and some bus fare, and I got a guy to give me a ride to Minneapolis, and I hitchhiked to San Francisco. I was this tall, the dumbest thing you ever saw, and I don't know how the hell I ever made it. But I stood outside of Minneapolis where they said the road to San Francisco, and I never hitchhiked. The car stops, where are you going, kid? I said, San Francisco? So am I, hop in. And away we went. Turned out he's the Navy going back to his ship. I don't know why he ever picked me up. All the way across the country, we'd stop at night. There were no motels there, but there were trailer cars. You'd get me a bed, buy my meals. And I just accepted that. I thought that when you hitchhike, you tell people where you're going and they get you there. That's all that is. And I told him I wanted to be in the Marines. He said, you're a little small and your face is full of pimples. I wouldn't suggest that. He says, you might get to the merchant marine, however, because they're so desperate. Everyone, all the good guys have gone to the Navy, and they'll take anybody. So he told me how to do that, and I went to the Coast Guard office there and showed me where I was. I want to be in the merchant marine. Fill out the application. And he told me, put down 16, because you'll never have a chance at 15. So I put down 16. He said, well, you're only 16, kid. You have to have your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. And they issued me Seaman's papers right there. I mean, no training, no nothing. It took another guy and I out of the National Maritime Union on Montgomery Street. We signed a waiver for dues, whatever the hell that was. Took us to the Embarcadero, put us on a ship. The afternoon, we're on our way to the South Pacific. And it really was fun for about an hour. Tailed off after that. But I was in a room with three of the worst type of people that any small, skinny, dumb Norwegian, Lutheran, insulated boy could be with. These kind of people are called men. What the hell are you doing in here? I understand now why they were upset, because I was the fourth man of their four-man crew, and they realized they're going to do their work and mine for the rest of that trip. But I saw there was some tension. I told them a joke that I was used to over good in the study hall. Didn't go over good there. I should get your damn bunk and shut up. And that ship was going around like this. That room was hot. I could smell the ocean. I really wanted my mother. But I didn't want to say anything and ruin my image. And these guys got talking, and I couldn't believe my ears. I couldn't. I mean, I had been kind of a sinner. I used the Lord's name in vain sometimes, and I stole some little things, and I wasn't very nice. But these were big-time sinners. I mean, big-time sinners. They'd been in San Francisco for several days with their ship, but they'd been doing dirty things with women every day. And I suddenly realized, of course, they've all got black hair. Those are the Catholics I've heard about. I don't want to give the wrong impression. At the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And these guys, they were doing it with people. And they all drank whiskey. They all had whiskey on the ship. It was just dreadful. I just was shocked. And they'd drink. And any other era, they'd have been pirates. You know, they'd have had patches on their arms. And they'd drink, and I'd just be appalled. And one day, one of these guys turned to me and said, "How about you, Junior? You think you're man enough for a little snort?" And he shoved a bottle in my face. Can you imagine? That was the first time I'd been in a room with a bottle of whiskey when I got that woman. And I determined, I'm going to stop this now. I may be dumb, but I'm going to let him know. And I was going to demolish this guy. I was going to say, "All right, you, take that bottle out of my face. I guess you don't know that I'm a Norwegian Lutheran. You probably have not seen any close-up of the way you people live, but we don't live the way you do, you Catholic. We don't live that way. And I don't want you, I'm never going to drink that stuff, and I promised my mother and grandmother I wouldn't, and don't you ever put it in my face again." I was just going to tell her that, and she said, "Well, you think you're man enough?" And I heard a voice say, "God damn right." So I had my first drink out of the first bottle I was ever close to, and I threw it up, and they laughed. To this day, I don't know an emotion that's worse than public humiliation. It's just terrible. I thought later, there's one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. They'd have thrown me overboard. But, you know, I wanted to say to this guy, "Lean over, you. Yeah. Take that." Just give one of the old eyes. But when nobody was around, all the way across the ocean, I got one of those guys sea bags every day. They were supposed to have whiskey on the ship. Who's going to stop them? And I'd take a drink of whiskey. Nobody was around. And I'd throw it up and have to wipe it up so they didn't know. And I hated it. But I so much wanted them to think I was a man. And we're just coming into Pearl Harbor finally. They're still digging up ships around us. Very exciting. And I was down there the night before my 16th birthday taking a drink of that crap. And it stayed down. And I couldn't breathe. Then something wonderful happened. I found myself feeling significantly better. And I didn't think about it. I don't know what it did for me, but it made me feel a lot better. Made me feel the way those guys looked. And the next day they took me to Honolulu and bought me 2 or 3 bottles of beer, and I got drunk, and I thought it was cute, and they thought it was cute, and I didn't become a terrible alcoholic at all. I just discovered there was a way to get rid of what that, I wouldn't have known it then by any means, but I know it now. But a few drinks gets rid of the scale for me. There's no scale. It's me, and I feel the way men look. What a great thing. And I drank it successfully and used it for further my life. When I got a little older, I went in the Navy. Then the war, the Naval Hospital being sewed together, and they passed on some tests. I wasn't great on tests. I got an honorary high school diploma, although I'm still a junior in high school. Went back to the University of Wisconsin after the war. Went through the university, won some trophies for the university. Found a lovely girl, married her. She had black flashing eyes and black hair. Just mysterious. And she won my heart and said, I'm a Catholic. I should have known. It was too late to do anything about it, so we got married. My grandmother went into a depression for about 2 years. She cried when she saw me. And out in the world, I became a sports writer, which is today the best, my favorite job I ever had, writing sports. But then my wife began manifesting the behavior patterns of Catholics, which I never knew about. Nobody ever told me, if you're a young Lutheran or Southern Baptist, you better listen to what your parents tell you. Because my wife began bearing children at a remarkable rate. I became a national distributor of small Catholics. I remember telling her once, can't we use birth control? No. But I would think about it. I know what I'd have done if she had said yes. It's hard for you young people to realize, but people in those days didn't talk about these things. I mean, if she would have said yes, I know what I'd have done. I'd been overseas, I'd been in a war, I'd been through a major university. I heard the word condom once in my life, maybe, in a Navy training film, where they showed this voluptuous girl with the big hooters and everything, just wonderful, and said, don't be with her, you may get some hideous disease. At that stage of my life, I wouldn't care what I got. If I could... I'll take my chances on taking an aspirin anyway. I mean, it's kind of funny. When I was a kid, you know, only bad kids had condoms. They didn't even call them condoms. They think like, I got a rubber. And they'd be ashamed to buy them. They'd have to hire someone depraved. And they'd go in and say, give me a pack of cigarettes and some rubbers. Now look at the progress we've made in the last 55 years. The drugstore over my house, kids come in. I guess they must be old enough. They look like kids. Come in and say, hey, give me a package of condoms and some cigarettes. Yeah. And so I had to get better jobs, and I got in advertising and public relations, and I was quite successful. I was pretty good at what I did. My only problem was I have a lot of emotions all the time. I have a lot of feelings, and I drink. Drinking is what makes it better. And my problem is sometimes I drink too much. Or as my psychiatrist pointed out to me, I have many times been thoughtlessly overserved. And when I drink too much, I become bizarre. And I go to jail and things like that, and some people said to me, you know, you're doing pretty good, but you're getting bizarre. Why should they got this new thing in town called AA? Why should you go to that? Some of the old timers in town are old drunks. They're cutting down even there. So I'm doing a meeting, about 7 or 8 fat guys sitting around the table, and just like getting that ship again. What the hell are you doing here? I didn't know why they acted that. I know why they acted that way now. Because I was 22, and there wasn't anybody in that state sober below 40. So they didn't expect that. But I didn't know that. The guy said, do you think you're an alcoholic? And I said, oh, God, no. What the hell are you doing here? Well, I think I'm too sensitive. Ah, ha, 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 let's do this one, Earl. Not you, Earl, another Earl. I never said that again for a long time, I'll tell you. But I went to AA off and on, but, you know, as I said, my problem is not alcohol. Alcohol is the answer to my problem. I got to find some way to control it, because alcohol makes it better, better than anything I know. If you're new tonight, I want to tell you something odd. Alcohol is the best friend I've ever had. Friends come and go. Jobs come and go. Lovers come and go. But when a few drinks is doing it for you, no matter where you are, God, it's wonderful. Just, oh, boy. And it goes down. I've often thought the test to see if you're an alcoholic. They test their blood, they test all sorts of things. But you want to know a good test to see if you're an alcoholic of our type? I think. Keep them off booze for a week, then give them a drink. And if they go, oh.
sit right down here, newcomer.
And I was always fighting that of drinking too much. And eventually I began to lose jobs. I got better jobs. And I lost big jobs and had a big job in Dallas. And I lost that. And they took away my car. And I got evicted. My wife and children took off. And didn't know where they went. And I wanted to try to drive a guy's car from Dallas to Los Angeles. Got caught in Phoenix. Got my teeth kicked out. Here I'm standing outside of a mission in Los Angeles. And I didn't know how to explain to him, God, I wish my problem were alcohol. I wish stopping drinking made it better for me, but it doesn't. They always tell me in the AA meetings, alcoholics can't stop drinking. I can stop drinking anytime. I've done it so many times. My problem is not that I can't stop. My problem is when I stop, sometimes the next day or a couple of days later, a little bit later, someone seems to sneak into my bedroom in the middle of the night and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day they start to tighten it. And it doesn't come out as I need booze. It comes out as just a little restlessness, a little irritability, a little tired of all the damn sermons. I'm still getting about what I used to do. And tedious. And I've spent so damn much money to try to beat that. And I'll tell you the way to beat it, the only way I've ever found, a couple drinks. But now the job is to control it. Never knew. If it does that for you, you're never going to control it. Control once in a while, but not forever. And I'm not an alcoholic. But I stood in that street corner, this guy, nobody came up to me and talked. I just knew it. I'm crazy, I'm going to die. But there's something I learned in my years of slipping in and out. And if anybody here is a slipper, we seem to have some slippers here. When you get so you really are getting bad, and smell bad, and look bad, there's only one place that I know you can go safely. That is an AA club. That is the only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like you.
This one's mine, Fred.
So I said, where's the AA club out here, pal? He said, well, there's nothing down here. There's one at Wilshire and Fairfax. I said, where the hell is that? He said, well, Wilshire doesn't come down this far. You have to go up this hill to Hill Street, then cut over to Wilshire, then walk west till you come to Fairfax. I said, all right. And I took off. I had no idea how far to go up this hill and over. I remember walking and walking and walking. Counted later, some years later, my car, 7.5 miles. That's a long way to walk in the rain and sick, my mouth bleeding, and just felt so bad. I remember walking by all these fancy stores on Wilshire Boulevard, the Miracle Mile, and cars going by, big cars, laughing. And I got to this club, and the same old stupid club as always, and the same old stupid steps on the wall, and the same old stupid tradition, the same old phony old hail, ho, 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 welcome home, you're home, son. And I lurked around that club all day, kept raining. I was waiting for it to stop raining so I could make my move. And there was a meeting, so I went to the meeting because they had some cake, and I ate about 4 pounds of cake because I could chew that. I sat in the meeting, somebody talked about gratitude, and I had a fight to keep from puking it up against Jesus. And everybody went home, it's still raining. I knew I was going to die if I'm not in that rain. There was just a manager and I were left, so I put on my newcomer look, which I'd polished, you know. I said, my name is Clancy, and what's going on? I'm a newcomer, and I have no place to stay, and it's raining, and I don't know what I can do. Can you help me? He says, you're in luck, kid. A guy named Joe Quinn left the 49 Merc in the parking lot. Doesn't run, but it's dry. You can sleep in that. Is this what AA offers in Los Angeles? A chance to sleep in an abandoned car? So, yeah, good deal, huh? Yeah, that's a good deal. And I still vaguely remember sleeping in that car. The reason I remember all those details about on the ship, and so I don't remember them at all. But somebody gave me a tape when I was 2 years sober, and I described it carefully, and I'm quoting my tape now. I'm not quoting what actually happened. I was closer to it than I hadn't become an octogenarian senile person. Hello, Dick. And the next morning I got up, it was cold, and went in the club at 8 o'clock in the morning. It was Sunday morning. And I ate some more cake. There was another spiritual meeting talking about God, and I got up and left that. I'll tell you the reason I couldn't stand here and think about God. I'm not an atheist. I'm not an agnostic. I'm a Norwegian Lutheran. I know that God exists. And I know that since I have broken all 10 commandments, there's no chance for me ever. And I don't care what anybody says or anybody wants to pat me on the back and say, oh, don't worry about it, son. I'm going to hell. And there's no way out of it. And so the best I can do is stay away from reminders of it. I sit in a sometimes, so I start talking about God, then I get up and leave. I just can't. There's nothing I can't go back and undo my life. And I lurked around the club all day, and that night the manager of the club says, well, you can stay here on the weekend, but you have to be a member during the week. But you're such a mess. I'm going to let you come in, but don't ask anybody for money, and don't none of your smart remarks. I'd already made a bad reputation. He said, and you have to go to a meeting in the club here every night. I thought, Jesus, I'd almost rather die. Hear another one of these boobs.
I stayed drunk for 25 years, night and day. One day I walked through that door. They told me to put the plug in the jug, and I did. And I've just never been so goddamn happy.
So I waited for it to stop raining, and I sat in that club all day and went to those silly meetings tonight. And I had no idea it'd be my sobriety day. Didn't want it to be. Had no desire to stop drinking ever. For me, stopping drinking is insanity and death. Now, how I knew that, because I stopped drinking once. I used to go to jail from time to time overnight. I'm no big felon like some of the AA members. But I get to a certain stage of drinking and I have to counsel police officers. And I just point out there, I'm a taxpayer, you son of a bitch, and I'll tell you what to do. Throw them in jail overnight. You know. And I got so I could just come out in the morning, take a shower, and go to work. I had it down to an art, you know. One night I came out of the jail and the guy was standing there waiting to give me a ride home. That never happened before. That's very nice of you. I'm sorry that you're bothering. He said, no, you should have stayed homeless. I said, I know, I'm going to do better. He said, no, well, you're out drunk. Your little son died. We couldn't find you. And that just about killed me because I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy, and he was the apple of my eye. And I just couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand it. I remember going back to Wisconsin to bury him, and I remember sitting in the living room with my father-in-law and two brothers-in-law, big farmer guys, nice guys. Now, Clancy, have a little more pastry. Have some more coffee. God, it must be terrible for you. They all said that, but in their eyes you could see, you dirty bastard. Look what you've done to our sister. You dirty bastard. But nobody said an unkind word. And before they buried my son, I put my hand in his casket unobtrusively. I said, John Emmerslin, this will never happen again. I swear to you, it never will happen again. I will never imperil anyone with my drinking, no matter what. And we went back to Texas. But I drank for a little while. I was trying to control it. I really couldn't control it, so I quit. I made a point of quitting for my dead son, John. And God, we had some few weeks there. It was just wonderful, because I was coming home from work and having dinner with the family and getting to work on time, and my daughters and I were getting along well. And it's almost like Easter. Somebody died, but he died for our sins. And we'd pray for him at every meal, and it was wonderful. It was probably the best 3 or 4 weeks of my life. And then somebody came into my bedroom one night and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day it started. A little restlessness, a little irritability, just a little tired of being treated like this. And I had a new culprit now. God, you killed my little boy that never committed a sin in his life to punish me because I'm a sinner. Well, screw you! And that was the end of God in my life. And I could not drink. The days went by and I got more and more tense. And my little daughter says, Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. For Christ's sake! Jesus, I'm sorry, we'll play tomorrow. I don't mean to. Get up, just leave. And hate myself for doing that. And I tried everything I knew. I could not drink. And the day finally came, it got so bad, my wife took the kids to mass. And I pulled the car in the garage to hook up a hose and exhaust pipe. Turned the motor and went to sleep and died. And a guy next door just sitting in a den or breakfast nook having a cup of coffee. You know, saw me go in there and heard the motor running and I didn't come out. So he walked over there and found me dead in the car. Pulled me out and beat my chest and breathed my mouth. They rushed me to the hospital. Examined me for several days. Determined I was seriously mentally ill. And committed me for an indefinite period to the Texas State Insane Asylum at Big Spring, Texas. Now that's how I get when I stop drinking, folks. That's no goal for me at all. It just gets terrible. You know, nothing in my commitment paper said alcohol, because I hadn't had a drink for some time. It said schizophrenic with paranoid tendencies. I've also debated going back to Texas someday and see if I could find that psychiatrist. He must be about 90 now. I could move him around pretty good. You old son of a bitch. That's older than Bill Roop. Not much. Never get smart with the person that has the microphone after you, Bill. But I'd like to find him and say, you diagnosed me as a schizophrenic, as a dual personality. You ought to lose your license. If I could have gotten my personalities down to two, I'd have been all right. My problem has always been this whole crowd of people in my head who get together whenever there's any pressure on. What do you think we ought to do? Maybe we should leave. I'm not sure. Do you think we can? I'm not sure. I hear people today say, used to hear people say, I'm not sure A is enough for me. I may need group therapy. Not me. I just go for a ride alone in my car. That's what's so good about alcohol. It reduces it to one voice. It may be a bad voice, but it's one voice. Why don't you quit your job and punch him in the face? But stopping drinking to me is terrible. I was in that nut house until the next year before I found a way out. So that stopping drinking to me is no incentive at all. Now, why would I stop drinking now? Why would I be sober? Of all things, as far as I can determine, I've thought about this and talked to a lot of people. In those first few meetings, I saw a guy in a couple of the meetings that I had seen in the movies. A movie actor. A movie actor. He must be very rich. So I thought, I'll bet he would like to have a new friend. So I eased on him, but he didn't want to be my friend. But that club was like every other fanatic AA group in the world. You know, you stayed there a few days, and people were buying me little meals sometimes, donuts and coffee at the coffee bar. And I was just waiting for it to stop raining. It just kept raining, like rain. Laying in a damn abandoned car at night. But near the end of the week, they started on me. Boy, you ought to get a sponsor. You're living in that abandoned car. You're going to die out there getting a sponsor. And I've had sponsors. These are sickening. But I thought, well, here's my chance. So I moved in an old Bob. I said, Bob, I put on my newcomer look. That's very hard when you're unshaven and covered with puke. Bob, I've always admired your program. Could you be my sponsor? I said, yes, I can, kid, but I want you to do what I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. I found out later that he wasn't really a big movie star at all. He'd been in three movies in his life, and I saw him in two of them. So I thought he's in all the movies. I've been in more movies than him. But I never, at the time, I just thought he was a movie star. And they said he wasn't a very good actor, but he was a good actor because he acted nicely in meetings. That took a lot of acting for him. He was a right-wing fascist AA pig is what he was. Just the worst sort. Do this, do that. Now, why am I taking this crap from this idiot? Because he was my only meal ticket out of there that I could see. I saw no other way I was going to get out of there ever. And I found out later he didn't like me. And I don't blame him. Because I don't want to brag. But I was the worst type of newcomer there ever is in AA. And I know that I've sponsored a couple of people like that. And they're kind of people, they walk in the room and say, hi. You just wish you could take out a rifle and say, here's high. I'll tell you what kind of a newcomer that is. That's a person who's been around AA year after year after year. And sooner or later, they always drink. And they come back and want attention, hold their hand up for newcomers and hit on the new girls. And you eventually hang around and drink again. And they come back. You can't tell them anything. I know all that. Don't bother telling me that crap. I heard that before you were ever so on. It just makes you crazy. And that's the way I was, I'm afraid. But he tried to help me. He was a good man. And once in a while, he took me to meetings, and I'd explain to him, I'm not really an alcoholic, Bob. I mean, I have some kind of a drinking problem, but I'm not an alcoholic. I should let you know that. You know, okay. And he'd take me to meetings sometimes, and he would sometimes hear him talk or something. We were standing on, I explained to him, alcohol is not really my problem. I know that. And one night we were somewhere, and he said to somebody, maybe me or somebody else, I don't know. He said, I heard him say, as long as you think your problem is alcohol, you're going to die drunk. I didn't say anything, but on the way home I said, Jesus, Bob, what do you say things like that for? You make me look bad being with you. You know, of course the problem was alcohol. That's what AA is about, a problem. I said, no, if your problem is alcohol, you shouldn't even be in AA. You're taking up space. I said, Jesus, Bob. Lights kind of hot on the set up there today, were they? I had the ability to enrage him at a moment's notice. I just couldn't do that. He said, no, kid. He said, the problem here is not alcohol. If you're alcohol, you don't need any. Well, what do you do, Bob? You get a series of shots? He said, no. But there seem to be alcoholics who can just stop drinking and clean up their act, and they live happily ever after. I said, that doesn't work. That's stupid. I've tried that 200 times. It doesn't work. He said, that's right, kid. It only works for people whose problem is alcohol. Apparently you've got what I got, which isn't alcohol. It sounds like it, but it isn't. And what could that be, Bob? He says, there's something called alcoholism. And, oh, Jesus, Bob. Don't play word games with me. I'm smarter than you are, and I'm smarter than most of the people you know. I look terrible, but I got a good brain. Alcohol, alcoholism, hooray, I'm cured, I'm cured. Shut up, he explained. But he gave me a long explanation, most of which I was able to blot out. Some of it snuck through and changed my life. And the gist of it was this. And you might, if you're new, you might think about this. If your problem is alcohol, but you do, you quit drinking, clean up your act, you're home free. However, if you suffer from this thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks almost exactly the same to the naked eye, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you'll discover that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, I never heard anybody say that before. They all say, stop drinking makes it better. I said, no, stopping drinking makes it worse for people like us. I said, Jesus. Then why do these alcoholics, whose problem is alcohol, why do they drink again? They know it's doing bad things to them. He said, don't you? You say you've been around 8-10 years. You don't know much at all. They don't drink for bad things to happen. He says, you know that alcoholics are people who have an unnatural reaction to alcohol. You know that, don't you? I said, yes, I do. It sets up the phenomenon of craving. And then they drink and drink and drink until they go crazy. So that's podium talk. The unnatural effect of alcohol on alcoholics, something much more important than that. He had a Coke in his hand. He said, when I have a couple drinks, it almost instantly changes my perception of things. When I have a couple drinks, it almost instantly alters my relationship to the world around me. When I have a couple drinks, it almost instantly makes me taller and more self-contained in my gut and them smaller and less threatening. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? And he said something rather coarse, I hate to say it, but I want to quote him correctly. He said, because it isn't really happening, you asshole. He said, and these people will probably, maybe the phenomenon of drinking kicks in and they drink too much, but they always get sober again. He said, nobody ever explained the phenomenon. Nobody understands the phenomenon of craving at all. And to this day, no one has ever explained the phenomenon of craving. But I have a theory, at least for people like me. When you really need a drink, and it makes things brief better, almost instantly starts to sag a little bit, and you instinctively drink some more. and you keep drinking to hold it. And you see the little old guy so drunk they can't stand up and, hey, give me a drink. You say, what the hell's wrong with you? You had too much to drink already. They don't want to drink. They're trying to hold it. But she eventually drank too much. She gets sober again. Always gets sober again. Don't need a detox. Don't need anything. All you need is a toilet and a cool piece of tile on your cheek. You get sober again. But he said, eventually, you get sober again. I said, okay. I never thought of it that way, but I understand that, Bob. It's quite understanding. Now these people know alcohol is eating them up. Why would they drink then? Even though they want to feel better, they don't feel better that bad. He said, that's the other part of it, kid. He said, you don't even learn much in your 10 years. And he had a theory. A few years ago, this guy gave me a tape of one of my early talks. And I found myself talking about something that I hadn't talked about in 30 years. And it is just as true as it can be. Something he said, kid, when people are born and grow up, it's tough being a kid. It's tough growing up in the world. You have to learn how to get along. You have to learn to find ways to solve problems. You have to avoid conflicts, or if you have conflicts, to find a way to resolve them. You have to learn that you have to give to get. Some days life is just a crap sandwich. You take a bite and chew it and swallow and keep going. And all sorts of things happen. So that process is called maturing. And if you become a mature individual, you can live a pretty comfortable life. You can hold a job, get along with your co-employees, get along with your kids, get along with the neighbors, go on square vacations and enjoy them. Have a lot of fun. He said, but this almost never happens to alcoholics. I said, why not, Bob? He said, because people like us have learned along the way when there's a conflict we can't deal with, or a problem we can't solve, we can have a few drinks and get rid of it. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch. I never liked you anyway. Hey, Mr. Collins, take your job and shove it up your nose. And it really works. Except what I don't know is I'm building a closet of unresolved emotions. And the day comes for people like me, as most people are, I'm sure. I'm going to quit. I'm going to really quit this time. I'm going to try to quit. And I'm gonna, not no particular reason. I'm just sick of getting this crap all the time. I'm going to quit. Go to work. Do my job. Come home, play with the kids. Just get along. And never once know it is impossible for me to do that. Because sooner or later, someone will trigger those emotions. For example, someone will hurt my feelings. Someone will put me down. Someone will treat me badly. And the fission starts. So, picture. When I was young, I used to pop people and quit the job. But when you got kids, you can't do that anymore. So you try to find ways to get even with them without people finding out. And just and the fission starts and it mounts and mounts and gets bad. Scientists who study people like us say people like us get to a point sometimes where we have to drink to preserve our sanity. Isn't that remarkable? And so sooner or later I drink and then it all goes again. And say, why did you drink? Oh, I was having some trouble on the job. I don't remember why. But George, he said this, that's why they will always drink again. I said, Jesus, Bob, that's the story of my life. I never heard anybody describe that before. That's the story of my life for the last, I've had big jobs. I've got a lot of acclaim. I've got a lot of great things. And I always blow it up and ruin everything. He said, there's a name for people like you. And I thought, uh-oh, what could it be? He said, you're an alcoholic. I thought, my God, if that's what an alcoholic is, that's what I am. I thought probably this person was alcohol. Partially sobriety. I said, my God, Bob, why doesn't AA explain it the way you do? Instead of this psycho babble about allergy of the body, the obsession of the mind, all that crap that means nothing. He said, they do, kid. Look at the wall. After that big number one, it asks you to admit you're having a problem with alcohol. And then there's a dash in the English language means end of thought, beginning of new thought. And now you also have to admit you're having a problem without alcohol. And if any of you new people are wondering about that, just think about it. If you weren't having problems with alcohol, you wouldn't be here. If you could still drink, you'd be out drinking. If you could stay sober comfortably, you'd be out staying sober comfortably. When you can't do either one, you get squeezed into rooms like this and watch your mind try to find ways to prove that you're different and get you back out again. Because the comfort comes with your next drink. I said, Jesus, Bob. That was December of 1958, and I'd been dry 6 weeks, I guess. And my life changed. My life apparently didn't change. I still didn't do very well, didn't get along with people, had jobs, got fired, didn't get along very well at all. But for the first time, I believed I was an alcoholic, not insane. God, what a relief that was. And eventually I stayed sober little by little. My sponsor always made me get jobs, and he wouldn't give me any money. That's fine. He wound up sleeping on people's sofas and in their basements, and I had a terrible time. I still had no teeth for years after I was sober. My sponsor thought I should take the money I was making and send it to those kids in Dallas. And little by little, I stayed sober. But something happened in that second, briefly my second year, I think. Maybe before that, maybe. I hadn't thought about this for a long time. But I had a secret that I had never told anybody. I wouldn't tell my sponsor. I wouldn't tell my psychiatrist. I wouldn't tell any friend, because if I told you, you wouldn't like me. I'll tell you what that secret is. I'm the only one that knows that I'm nothing. I'm morally corrupt. I'm intellectually corrupt. I'm a phony. I pretend to be hip and slick and cool, and I'm nothing. I'm nothing. And if you know that, you wouldn't like me. I remember sitting one night at Bob, I was thinking about committing suicide. He said, tell me what's wrong. I said, okay, you want to know what's wrong? I'll tell you. And I told him that. And I know he would wait for him to get up and say, you ought to be ashamed and walk away. He said, I understand that. I've heard that a lot. Really? And I had never been able to live with that secret. And he didn't seem to be shocked by it. And we talked a long time. But the outgrowth of that was this. I began to little by little believe that he knew how I felt. Which doesn't sound like much, except I have never known anybody that I believe knew how I felt. My dad didn't. My doctor didn't. My minister didn't. My bosses, they all said they did. We know how you feel, son. And you have to say, gee, thanks. But you want to say, no, you don't, God damn it. You don't know how I feel. And what's so important about having somebody know how you feel? I'll tell you what it is. It boils down to this. Everyone in this room has had enough advice to last them 10,000 years. People like us are just magnets for advice from every idiot in the world. Passers-by. Think you ought to go to rehab. What's so important about having someone know how you feel? Because that advice becomes meaningful information. And you have to think, Jesus, he knows how I feel, and that's what he... And it may get you to take actions you'd never take for anyone in the world. I remember standing in the Brentwood meeting, which was a fancy meeting at that time, with my sponsor, all fancy people. I had some old clothes on, but at least I've shaved. I've been sober a few weeks. I said, see that woman over there? Yes, I see her. I want you to apologize to her. Why should I? Someone told me that the Monday night meeting at the club, you called her a bitch. She is a bitch. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girl to stay away from me. Well, she's right. You apologize. I can't think of a person in the world would have told me that I wouldn't have said, to hell with you. Go over there and abase myself in front of her so she can go to all the meetings she goes to and say, I made that Clancy knuckle under and treat me like a piece of crap. Bob, I'm working to be something, and I have to take that kind of crap. But it was somebody that I believed knew how I said, felt. And I found myself saying,
sorry, I called you a bitch.
You bitch. I understand you're going to quit your job. Jesus, Bob, you got to be stuffing envelopes for $1.10 an hour. I used to have an office bigger than this whole company. He said, well, you stay on that job until you get a better job. I understand you're not going to the Friday night meeting anymore. Oh, it's a big trick, Bob. They all suck around. They ridicule me because I got old clothes and got no teeth and they treat me like a piece of crap. Maybe they know something you don't know. And did that again and again and again. Just terrible. By the time I was in my second year, however, I held a job 4 months before I screwed it up. And I really felt I'm ready to make my move. And just after I was 2 years sober, I got a job as a beginning writer in a big medical corporation. And I'd been a successful writer, but I was so glad to get this. I thought, I'm going to make my move on this job. I'm going to make that breakthrough. Here's my chance. And I had somebody got me down to the thrift shop, got me good clothes, could use clothes. Still had no teeth. I learned to carry my lip like this. I just thought I'd been burned in a fire. And I went to work, and I was, boy, I got through the first couple days, I wrote some great stuff. They said, you're really good, kid. Thanks a lot. And about the fourth day, somebody hurt my feelings. Somebody said, I heard him laughing about he doesn't have any teeth. I'm trying so hard to do something. I worked so hard, and I want to pop you. I just want to pop you. And I promised that rotten Bob that I'd call him before I quit. Bob! This guy could put me down. Here's what you do. And he told me some stupid thing to do. I said, that doesn't work with a guy like this, Bob. You don't know him. He said, do it. And I did it. And the guy says, gee, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. I really like you. I think you did a wonderful job. I'd try to be friendly. So I got through that. There must have been maybe 50 times in my first year that someone got those emotions going. And I'd call up Bob, and he'd give me some stupid thing to do, and I got through it. And I got through it little by little. My actions and perceptions changed. When I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that big medical corporation. I had teeth. If any of you new people have lost teeth, let me give you some hope. Once you become spiritually pure, they grow back. When I was 10 years sober, when I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought to Hollywood, and we created something called Boss Radio. Became the number one hard rock station in the world. You remember that, Earl? When I was 10 years sober, I was doing public relations with an oil company. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Dallas, Texas. Leaped out of their post office box, rushed to my side, attached themselves to me like a group of starving chiggers. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. Thank God somebody gave me a book on the rhythm system. We ended all that. Now they're all grown up. Oh, getting old, I guess. Three of my daughters turned 18 this year in AA, the most recent one 2 weeks ago. And don't clap. Did you see that? Did you see me do that? I've done a wonderful job with them. I didn't even help them at all. They told, I was surprised they all turned in. And my other children are alcoholic. My last child was a son again, so I had a son. He was all my daughters. And much to my chagrin and frustration, he has turned into an alcoholic, and I can't help him. All over the world, I sponsor people. I got some in this room, and I sponsor people all over the world, and long distance, locally. And I can't help my own son. And that's the nature of alcoholism. I have for years been telling people, don't try to help your kids, you can't help them. But it's different when it's your kid. Maybe I can help them. But I can't. He's in his 40s now. And his wife has left him. His job's on the line. He's got a great job. It's on the line. And I hardly ever see him. I said to his separated wife, who still loves him, I said, "Diana, why doesn't Clancy ever come around me? I love him, and we always used to be so close." He said, "Well, he never wants you to see him smelling like alcohol, and he always smells like alcohol." God, that's such a frustration. That's just the nature of alcoholism. You accept it, I guess. And I accept it. I don't like it, but I accept it. I think of my daughters. They've all tried to talk to him, and he won't listen to anybody. He's been raised. He knows more about AA than most AAs because he's been surrounded by them. But that's the nature. Only one of my kids has ever turned out bad. My oldest daughter has become a judge. We so much wanted a defense attorney, but no. She comes home for Christmas a few years ago. She says, "Daddy, remember you used to send us to our room when we were little girls?" I said, "Sure, honey." She said, "When you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room." I have no need to go to Albuquerque. But that's all very nice, did I say? One of the things I want to say quickly to the new people. I'm talking to the new people now, although I'm trying to make it sugary so it'll go down. But the one thing they'll do around A, even if you can accept you're an alcoholic, they won't let up on that. They start on this, "Time to work the steps, time to get working the steps." And I told Bob, "Bob, I appreciate you and I admire you, but I cannot return to God. I cannot return to God." He says, "Nothing in AA says you have to return to God." Oh, I said, "Come on, Bob. You mean to a power greater than myself, Bob? I know what the hell they're talking about, and so do you." He says, "It doesn't say that. Why don't you look at the wall? It asks you to come to believe in something, not to return to anything. AA never asks you to return to any sickness. It says, come to believe in something. Can't you come to believe in God?" I said, "No, I can't, Bob." "Can't you believe in AA?" "Well, I like it better than I used to, but not much." He says, "You think I'm doing better than you are?" I said, "Of course you are, Bob." He said, "Congratulations. I'm your new higher power." And I could accept that because he couldn't send me to hell. He tried, but he couldn't. But I did things he said, and little by little, things began to get better. But if you study that step, you know, there's a funny little thing at the end. Came to believe that a power greater than myself. The thing you want to remember, you don't have to know what that power is at the moment or how it works. You have to combine the power. You don't have to know how it works. You have to believe that it will restore you to sanity. But what the hell does that mean? You can read 10 medical books on mental health, and you'll get 10 different definitions of sanity. Oddly enough, insanity is easy to define. When the brain is under, this is kind of oversimplification, but it's true, when the brain is under sufficient conflict that it can't stand it, in effort to maintain its neural integrity, it will alter its perception of reality. That is called psychosis. And psychosis, sometimes it's the whole world changes and you're easy to spot and you're put away. Usually they're just small amounts, so something has to trigger it. Like reading the paper about, I remember reading this guy came home, kind of destroyed this guy for 10 years, nice guy, but he came home one night, I don't know why he did it, took a rifle, killed all his kids, killed his wife, killed himself. Something triggered his psychosis. It really is a dreadful thing. And once you become psychotic, you stay psychotic. We all talk today about, "I'm psychotic and I'm not." Once you make it, you're over there. But alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Isn't that funny? You'd think it would really be a number one thing. But alcoholics, you may hear, if you're new, you hear, well, they say alcoholism is the second greatest cause of insanity. How do you explain that? The explanation is it's a different form of insanity. It's kind of interesting to know that. Anyone here who's been drunk a lot knows how it feels in the morning to wake up and need something to put the fire out. Why would you get thirsty from drinking fluids? Because alcohol is the only substance I know, only fluid, that dries out your body. As it moves through your bloodstream, it kills the cells it touches. It's called desiccation of cells. You kill the cells all through your body. And all you do in the next day when you drink fluids, and they come alive. And the next time you drink, they die. And the next time you come with fluids, they drink. This happens thousands of times, just on and off, on and off, on and off. Unfortunately, there are two organs in the body that when the cells die, they do not revive. One is your liver, one is your brain. That's why people like us wind up with bad livers and bad brains. And it takes a lot of drinking, a long time, but you can eventually dry out enough cells in your brain so you can't function. That is called the Korsakoff syndrome. It's ironic, in AA we call that a wet brain. It's a dry brain. And you may think maybe you suffer from it, but you don't, you won't be here. You probably never see a case of it. I see them all the time. I wish I didn't. But they're not roaming the streets or acting crazy to Amy's. They're sitting in a ward somewhere. And people come and change their diapers and feed them and put them to bed and get them up and change their diapers and feed them and put them to bed and get them up. And they can never get better. It's very much like the last stages of Alzheimer's. Except Alzheimer's has the decency to kill the patient finally. They can live like that for 50 years if their body's strong enough. The families come down and see if mom knows them. You know it's mom? Who the hell are you? Get away from me, you terrible. They cry and go home. You may never see a case of it and be, I hope you don't, because they are a terrible thing. But that is alcoholic insanity. Why don't alcoholics become psychotic? It is so simple, I can't imagine why I never thought of it. When it gets bad enough, long enough, I drink alcohol. And alcohol has the power to alter my perception of reality. I have the power to induce temporary psychosis. Although I never dreamed of it and had any idea of it. And that's why alcoholics don't become truly psychotic. So I guess what the second step means, maybe it means what it says, like so much of AA. Come to believe there's a power here that will make it for me unnecessary for me to induce psychosis to stand it, to keep me from drinking. That's all you have to believe. You say, how does it work? Don't have to know how it works. Just work. And the third step, which is the last step I'm going to talk about, is kind of tough because you have to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand. But if you're not comfortable with God, you have a terrible time. I couldn't do that. So I rewrote it in my mind. I will try to do what Bob says, which is the best thing I ever did, because it gave me a power greater than myself that I could follow. And as a result of taking his actions, I eventually came to believe in AA. As a result of coming to believe in AA and taking a lot of actions here, my perceptions changed. I came to believe in a God. And I got another sponsor when Bob died, and he was a big spiritual guy, not religious, but spiritual. And he told me, he said, you're not important enough for God to hate, kid. Just try doing these things. And little by little, I tried praying. I thought, oh God, what if there's a lightning bolt and got me? But I've prayed earnestly to that God for well over 45 years. And I believe he loves me. I believe he loves me the same as he loves you. No more, no less. I don't think he loves some people better than others. I think we have, our job is to somehow take actions that will open our damn heads long enough for a little of God's grace to get in from time to time. Because we're by nature selfish, self-centered, nasty people. And we need all the help. But that saved my life. To come to believe, the problem is not alcohol. The problem is drinking is my best friend, but it's turned on me and sobriety is untenable. Somewhere here there's a power here because all these people didn't stay sober just so they could come and fool you. They've got a power in their lives. And then you can turn your life over to that power. And about the last thing I want to say is this. I think this is kind of amusing. Sometimes new people say, well, why does it work? We have an answer to that. Why does it work? Have that right here. Rarely have we seen a person fail who is thoroughly, no, that's what they mean at all. They mean, how does it work? How does this work? And I'll tell you something that may stagger you. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. It's scary. Except for as you go along, you realize who cares. But I always think about in the 1700s, one of the worst diseases in the world was smallpox. If you got smallpox, it's just an epidemic. They'd wipe out cities. In 1781, when Washington was going to march on Valley, alcohol, the problem is Drinking is my best friend, but it's turned on me, and sobriety is untenable. Somewhere here there's, you know, there's a power here, because all these people didn't stay sober just so they could come and fool you. They've got a power in their lives. And then you can turn your life over to that power. And about the last thing I want to say is this. I think this is kind of amusing. Sometimes new people say, well, why does it work? We have an answer to that. Why does it work? Have that right here. Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly... No, that's what they mean at all. They mean, how does it work? How does this work? And I'll tell you something that may stagger you. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. It's scary. Except for, as you go along, you realize who cares. But I was thinking about in the 1700s, one of the worst diseases in the world was smallpox. If you got smallpox, it's just an epidemic. They'd wipe out cities. In 1781, when Washington was going to march on Valley or on Yorktown, he almost couldn't because Philadelphia was so immersed in this terrible disease. I got a book home called Bring Out Your Dead about that era in Philadelphia. Wagons go through the streets and bring out your dead. You bring out your dead mother and throw her in the wagon, or your dead baby. Just dreadful. And no answer. Nobody knew about bacteria or germs or nothing. It just looks like God punishing people. And it happened in London, wiped out a fifth of London, wiped out a bunch of... Just terrible. There was a doctor in London who was so interested. He said, there must be an answer. I can't see what it is. And he worked with people. He went right amongst these people with smallpox and didn't catch it, fortunately. And he ran across a stunning thing. There were a bunch of girls who milked cows who did not get smallpox. What the hell's that got to do? Because here's a bunch of girls who milked cows who did get smallpox. What is it? What are they dead? And he finally determined the one thing they had in common, they all had had a minor disease called cowpox, which many times happened in milkmaids. And he thought, and the people who had cowpox never got smallpox. Is that just a coincidence or what? He did one of the classic medical tests of the world. He bought a little boy named Jimmy Phipps, 9 years old. He took him to where these women had cowpox, He didn't know anything about how you transfer germs. Didn't know germs. Just he knew that cut a little slash in his arm and took a handful of blood and pus and rubbed it in there. And the kid got sick and got better. But then he took him to where they're dying of smallpox. There's no answer now. And he took a stick and got some blood and pus and rubbed the kid's arm, and the kid got very sick and got better. And that day they discovered how you stop smallpox. You take cowpox. But no one in the heart, who wants to believe that? You mean you try to tell me you get one disease to keep from getting another disease? That's stupid. But some people believed him, and they survived. Here's the interesting little nugget. The Latin word for cow is vaccus. The word vaccination means injection of the cow. And it wasn't for 100 years later they finally found out why that is. It turns out when they got microscopes and understood things about germs and bacteria and viruses, and that cowpox sets up antibodies which stops the spread of smallpox in the body. But for 100 years people had to take it on spec. I sometimes think that's the way AA is today. Maybe 100 years from now, some crazed scientist will stagger out of his laboratory and say, I found out why Alcoholics Anonymous works. It turns out that taking a series of strange actions under the direction of a cruel tyrant sets up a flood of endorphins to the upper cerebral cortex, making it unnecessary to drink. They say, oh, doctor, wonderful, wonderful. It won't help us, we'll all be dead. So you're in a position of those, we're in a position of Dr. Jenner in London, talking to the new guy and the new girls and the new people. Here's our message to you. Take the cowpox. Take the cowpox. Take the cowpox. Keeps you alive. Keeps you alive. The last thing I want to say quickly, give you some bad hope. is that Alcoholics Anonymous, it turns out, I thought, what's it for? How dry can you get? God, I've been dry 48 years. I'm about to burst into flame. Bill Roop already has. You can tell by looking at him. But it isn't about getting dry at all. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe my whole life with this, is to slowly do what alcohol does fast. That's all. To little by little change my perception of reality so the whole world begins to look different. To change my relationship to the world around me so I live at peace. To change my inside so I'm not afraid and threatened by everybody who looks at me funny. It's a great thing, and it changes your life. The problem is sometimes it changes it more than you want to. When I was 15 years sober, I was doing pretty good. I was slicker and snot. And somehow, one day I found myself leaving that job in Beverly Hills. And for the last 34 years, I've been the managing director of the Skid Row Mission that threw me out in 1958. And I've done a wonderful job. You people, stop it! I've never seen a class like this. And sometimes people say, why would you give up your big money-making job in Beverly Hills to run that damn mission? And I could never think of a good answer. Well, for such a significant decrease in salary, I couldn't pass it up. Well, I'm still looking for those two guys that threw me out. Once I punish them, I'll be all right. I don't know why. But I'll do something Monday morning. I'm sure none of you will do. I live in a house out by the ocean. And I'll get in the morning and smell the ocean breezes, then get in my car and drive through Beverly Hills on Highway 10. My car still wants to get off on La Cienega, but I have to fight it back on. And I'll go down to Skid Row, the terrible part of Los Angeles, and park my car underneath our building, and I'll walk around the building, and I'll step over bodies of men and women and children, not so much different than anybody here, who are dying from alcoholism and drug addiction and insanity and abandonment. And I'll go in and spend the day Monday with the other people like me, and we'll try to find some ways, if we can, to get these poor bastards to acknowledge their sickness, to become willing to take actions that they want to take, to find some way, we're not a treatment center, we're way below, try to keep them alive. And I'll go home at night and I'll feel pretty good. And it's an amazing thing, I would never thought I'd like to do that, but I told you earlier, I've just turned 80, and everybody says, why don't you retire? I just don't want to retire, I look forward to it every morning. There's people down there, God damn it, I'm going to get. And hopefully get them well enough to eventually send them to AA. That's kind of an odd thing. But if you're new tonight, you know, you have to find something. I would suggest you run a mission. There's not enough to go around. I got mine, and that's for you. But remember this. Apart from all the stuff I've just said for hours here, it boils down to one sentence. And it's all of it has been prelude to this one sentence. Alcoholics Anonymous, at the bottom line, is exactly the same thing tonight in Atlanta, Georgia, as it was June 10th, 1935 in Akron, Ohio when it started. They didn't have meetings, they didn't have books, they had none of these things. Here's what they had and what you and I have. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And when that moment comes, life starts. Thank you.